This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome to the latest installment of Close Readings. In this series, we are taking each time an individual poem, one we've chosen because it is in one way or another a political work, or a work about politics, or it has been read politically. My name is Seamus Perry, and I teach English at Balliol College in Oxford, and I'm talking to Mark Ford, poet, critic, professor of English literature at University College London. And our poem today is a work first published in 1847 by Elizabeth Barrett Browning called The Runaway Slave at Pilgrim's Point. So, Mark, the political interest of this poem is fairly obvious from the beginning. It's an abolitionist poem, a poem written in the cause of the ending of slavery. So perhaps we should say something to begin with about the culture of abolitionism or the literary culture of abolitionism.
Yes, I mean, this was for the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society, which was an abolitionist movement, which was developing a language which was condemning of slavery in alliance with slave narratives such as those by Frederick Douglass. And I think when you're looking at abolitionist writing, you all the time have to be very, very aware of the context in which it's being received, that the abolitionists have a strategy whereby they can present certain details but not other details. So in many sort of slave narratives, such as say that of Sojourner Truth, published in 1851, the fact that she was raped is not mentioned, because that would upset the white female readership that absorbed abolitionist writings. The idea was that abolitionist writings would convert middle-class women, who would then convert their husbands to the cause. And that's how the kind of snooker game would go on in some ways. One ball hitting another ball, hitting another ball. So there's a sense often that the melodrama of this poem plays into, obviously, the sort of taste that Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin would capitalize on so kind of powerfully in 1852. And that becomes the best-selling book on the planet, you know, outsells Dickens and so on. So abolitionists had to be careful about how much, about not upsetting their readership. But this poem does go right to the edge, and she called it ferocious herself. And the story it tells is one which is absolutely harrowing, and had actually been told her by a cousin of hers about a Jamaican slave, because we should say now that Elizabeth Barrett's money came from slavery, that her family had been slaveholders since 1655, and that she was the wealth of her father, Edward Barrett Moulton Barrett, who seems to me to have been an utter monster, derived from his slave plantations. Of course, 1833, the Emancipation Act, meant that he had to release his slaves, so to speak, from his plantations in Jamaica. But he got £7,000 in compensation from the government. But that did mean that the Barretts had to move from their idyllic Hope End rural retreat and up to London. They moved to Wimpole Street, from which she made her famous escape with
famous
Robert.
Famous escape, absolutely.
Just before this poem was written.
So there are complications, let's say, about her relationship with the institution of slavery, aren't there? She certainly inherits quite a lot of money from her grandmother and her uncle that comes from slave labour. But at the same time, she was a very enthusiastic supporter for the Emancipation Act of 1833. And she said she was extremely glad that the slaves, she says in a rather equivocal phrase, the slaves were virtually free. This poem, however, comes out very militantly against slavery as an institution. And it does something more interesting even maybe than that, which is to try and make some sort of connection between slavery and the political political institutions of American, the American Constitution.
Absolutely. And I think she may have been sort of got the idea of that from the name of the annual, Liberty Bell. Liberty Bell, the bell was the bell which was rung when the Declaration of Independence was read out to the people in 1776. And she goes back to the Mayflower Pilgrims who arrive in 1620 at Plymouth Rock. So famously at Plymouth Rock, the Mayflower arrives with the first colonizers, if or however you want to put it. She presents them in the first stanza as kind of seeking liberty, where they were seeking kind of religious freedom away from the perils of creeping Catholicism, as they saw it.
The established church.
And the established church. Exactly. And perhaps somewhat implausibly, this slave has escaped from the South and made her way all the way to Massachusetts to pilgrim to the point. So again, the theatricality of it is foregrounded by its title and its concept, that this slave has made her way to the point where the Mayflower landed. And at this moment, the slave hounders, the catchers are on her trail.
Yeah.
And this is the speech she gives just before they seize her and kill her. Well, I think the sense is that they stone her at the end.
That's something like that is implied, isn't it? Yes, it's worth looking at that first verse, isn't it? Because it does introduce, it's one of these very deftly sort of choreographed poems, isn't it, which turns around a number of words that get reiterated and a number of ideas or images that get repeated throughout. I stand on the mark beside the shore of the first white pilgrim's bended knee, where exile turned to ancestor and God was thanked for liberty. I have run through the night, my skin is as dark, I bend my knee down on this mark, I look on the sky and the sea. So, as you say, the Pilgrim Fathers are associated with an idea of liberty, although actually the idea of liberty that they were interested in was nothing much to do with the 19th century liberal idea of individual political liberty, which is the kind of conflation that she's rather deftly making. And by bending my knee down on this mark, she's absolutely pressing a button, isn't she? An iconic representation of the slave, as in Wedgwood's famous cameo of the slave bending his knee. Am I not a man and a brother? So, I mean, the first little verse is doing quite a lot of work, setting up a kind of white, dark antithesis, also associating with the sky and the sea a kind of absolute freedom, which has lost any kind of human implication or imprisonment. And it's also dramatic. That's an important thing for us to note, isn't it? She's writing a dramatic monologue, little bit like the sort of thing that Robert Browning might be writing.
Yes, and she was actually writing it on honeymoon, having escaped herself from Edward Barrett Moulton Barrett, who then cut her off without a penny and returned all her letters and never spoke to her again. He didn't want any of his children to marry, and any who did got the same treatment. So, and it's been thought that it may have been because it was fear of some kind of miscegenation had happened on the Jamaican plantations, and one of these children that his children might give birth to would have skin that wasn't completely white. So the anxiety of racial miscegenation kind of stalks the white imagination. And as in many much abolitionist writing, the hypocrisy of the slave owners is something that is kind of implicit throughout the poem, that they say they believe in liberty. Well, they don't. That the keeping of slaves is in conflict, A, with the notion of the notion of religious liberty as it was used, as it was figured in writings about the Puritans of the 17th century, but also in terms of the Constitution. And of course, Jefferson and Washington had slaves and so on. So there's a sense in which even at the founding moment, the Constitution is only speaking for the white populace. Mm. By 1830s, 1840s, that rhetoric was being used by abolitionists to expose the hypocrisy of all those who are in favour of slavery. But what she's doing as well is transforming it or displacing it from Jamaica to America, which is a kind of interesting move that she's making. Obviously, she's writing for an American publication, but her involvement with slavery was with Jamaica, and that's then transposed to America. A little bit, perhaps, the way that Conrad in Heart of Darkness attacked Belgium imperialists rather than British imperialists. But the story that it tells of a woman who murders her own child is pretty extreme for the time. It's been made famous in our time by Toni Morrison's Beloved, which has that as the central gothic element in it. But this story, which was a true story that she was told by her Jamaican cousin, is, and the reason she does is because she's been raped by her master.
Yeah.
It's implied she's been gang raped almost by a whole kind of team of the plantation owners, and she cannot bear her white child.
Yeah. And as you say, she knows she's writing a work that is going to be difficult. She knows she's writing something that is, you know, emotionally problematic, doesn't she? She tells Mary Russell Mitford, "Nobody will print it, I am certain, because I could not help making it bitter." So there's a deliberate kind of moral astringency and awfulness that she's calculating. So let's pick up again that point about a kind of a formative doubleness of standards, that the land of liberty should also be the land of enslavement. That is a recurrent theme, isn't it, in lots of abolitionist writing, even, you know, all the way back to Dr. Johnson, who wonderfully says, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes?" That's before the Declaration of Independence. And I suppose what Barrett Browning is thinking about are things in the Constitution, like, you know, "No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law," things like that. And the whole terrible legalistic complication of slavery is that the slave is regarded as a piece of property rather than a person. So the denial of liberty, in some curious and horrible way, kind of manages to be constitutional.
Yes, and things will become even worse a couple of years after the poem was published with the Fugitive Slave Act, which meant slaves who escaped to the North, people in the North were breaking the law if they didn't help in the capturing of these slaves and returning of them to their owners, in inverted commas. So she is absolutely appalled by this very concept of people as property, and her, you know, the things she believed in were liberty. You know, she was absolutely committed to the idea of liberty, and the causes that she espoused were ones which, and she was influenced as well by the writings of such as Carlyle, and the idea that poetry could be political and could take a stance, and that comes up in some of her later writing. And she wrote a couple of other abolitionist poems as well later on. This is her first one, and it takes a kind of ballad narrative, isn't it? So it does tell a story which is easy to follow, and it sort of rhymes ABABCCB pretty much throughout. There are a few variations, and it has this rhetorical kind of exuberance in some ways. I am black, and yet God made me, they say. But if he did so, smiling back, he must have cast his work away under the feet of his white creatures with a look of scorn, that the dusky features might be trodden again to clay. And trodden again to clay is pretty visceral as well, isn't it? A lot of the language of this poem is extremely distressing, really.
That's an interesting stanza, isn't it? That's the fourth verse, and that's where we start to get one of the fascinating elements running through this poem, which is really quite a kind of radical take on the uses of religious language or the uses of Christianity in the establishment and the perpetuation of slavery. That's quite radical in a way, isn't it? I mean, there's the white angels we get a bit later on. We get a white god. It's a very sort of, I mean, for a writer like Barrett Browning, who was herself very pious, this is a very ambitious and adventurous kind of treatment of religion as an institution.
Yes, and in slave narratives, very often there is a sort of divided relationship of the speaker with religion. How can this be happening? Many slave narratives were written by quite pious people, but Douglas, in his mercilessly, satirizes the hypocrites who go to church and then go home and whip their slaves. And I suppose his narrative dramatizes one of the dilemmas I think that this poem also brings to the fore, of what is the best form of resistance to take I mean, Douglas believes in education, and he by learning to read, that's how he learns to escape. But actually, the moment where he sort of achieves his kind of sense of himself as a free man is when he physically fights with Edward Covey and defeats him, he says. And 99.999 times he'd just have been sent to the whipping post and then sold down south. For some reason, that doesn't happen. But when you've got a woman, it's a slightly different issue, that she is a kind of, though she has run away and murdered her child, she is, in some ways, inciting rebellion. It's quite a sort of dangerous poem in that sense for those pro-slavers, that it does suggest some kind of uprising at some point might happen. She is also quite a sort of passive figure in her address to a white god in the sky, and her victimhood at the end, when she somehow, which she embraces in some ways, and in that way becomes, to an extent, a martyr.
I think part of what makes it so interesting as a dramatic monologue is the way that Barrett Browning has attempted to imagine a psychology that has unwittingly kind of internalized the value structures of the appalling society in which she lives, in which the character lives. So I think this is, in a way, the most impressive thing about the poem, the way that the speaker tries to analyze her experience in terms of a black-white dichotomy, which obviously we as readers know doesn't work. But that's, as it were, what her society has given her to work with. And you can see her trying to apply it, getting puzzled that there are dark animals who seem perfectly happy running around, dark streams rippling out of sight and dark frogs chanting. And they seem to be okay, but they are dark. So there's this kind of curious sort of, you know, cognitive disjunct that Barrett Browning is trying to dramatize.
And for us, the absurdity of kind of these racial categories emerges. Do you think it emerges for her as writing the poem as well? There's a sense that this is a deliberate kind of parody or a parodic exploration or dramatization of these ridiculous polarities.
I think by the time you get to the White Angels, towards the end of the poem, then I think there is a kind of, you know, rather perhaps heavy-handed, kind of sardonic kind of treatment of those sorts of categories, those kind of dualistic categories. I don't know. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, I suppose as a victim, she's a bit like Marion Erle from Aurora Leigh. And she has a terrible experience that she falls in love, and the man she falls in love with is then kind of killed, and she then experiences this appalling rape, and then gives birth, and then she kills her child. And we should look at that passage because it's pretty visceral. But after that, she carries her dead baby around with her on her breast. And in terms of images of awfulness, the poem is pretty unsparing, isn't it? And certainly, she worried that the Liberty Bell wouldn't print it because it was so extreme.
What do you think of the love plot? Before we get on to the infanticide bit, it's quite an important episode, isn't it? In the psychological kind of trajectory of the poem, is that she falls in love in a way that seems entirely reciprocated. Though, I mean, how plausible this is within the world of the plantation, I simply don't know. It seems to be, so this is the ninth verse, it seems to be an exchange of looks between herself and the male slave, which then gets converted, and this is rather kind of difficult in some ways, isn't it, in the tenth verse, into an experience of freedom. And from that hour, our spirits grew as free as if unsold, unbought. So romantic love is unpicking the damage of enslavement, seems to be what she's saying, isn't it? They were as free as if unsold and unbought. Oh, strong enough since we were two to conquer the world, we thought. The drivers drove us day by day. We did not mind. We went one way and no better a freedom sought. And it strikes me that kind of rather complicates the politics of this poem.
I think it's the basic thing that happens in so many slave narratives is it's simply saying we are human.
Yes.
We are not, it goes back to your point about property. We are not animals. And that the whole of slavery works on the assumption that the slave is equivalent to a horse or a mule.
Yeah.
And the assertion of love is the primary way of insisting on one's own humanity, that one's no different from anyone else. So I think the love plot in some ways is an attempt just to make, in a very basic way, that most fundamental of the points of the abolitionist movement, that slaves are people and not animals.
Yeah, it's interesting too, isn't it, that to underline that point about the love plot being a way of recognizing the individuality of the slave rather than the, you know, the anonymity of the slave, that Elizabeth Barrett Browning should emphasize the fact of the name, that it's the man's name that she sings over and over again. Only a name, a name. Now, of course, the terrible irony is we never learn what his name was.
And his name
was.
Would have been his master's name. They had no right to name themselves. I think this also ties into the audience enjoyment of sentimentality as well in terms of the abolitionist movement. I mean, for modern readers, Uncle Tom's Cabin can be quite cloying at moments because of the sentimentality. But in terms of the abolitionist movement, sentimentality was one of the main drivers of conversion.
Yeah.
That if you could make people weep, then you could convert them to the abolitionist cause. So it's this covers that angle in terms of the abolitionist program, that the sentiment of two people who are not that any different from you, reader, gentle reader, and falling in love, that he is then they dragged him where I crawled to touch his blood's mark in the dust. Not much, ye pilgrim souls, though plain as this. And by mark, she's making this kind of connection between the mark on Plymouth Rock, where the pilgrims landed, and the mark of his blood-soaked ground where he was killed. In fact, a slave owner wouldn't have killed him, because he's valuable property and or would have done everything to avoid it. But in terms of the melodrama of the poem, and I think it does make use of kind of melodrama in the way it operates, that is pressing buttons in the abolitionist readership, which will ignite inflamed feelings and hopefully spread the justice of the cause.
And we do know, don't we, that Browning admired Uncle Tom's Cabin a lot.
Yes.
I mean, as you say, everyone did.
Yes.
Especially in the the mid-century liberal intelligentsia, that it was just a treasured book.
Yes, I mean, Abraham Lincoln, you know, let me shake the little hand of the little woman who made the big war and so on. And it was completely so that those tactics did work in terms of sentimentality and melodrama, in terms of converting a white middle class readership to the cause. And so the poem shouldn't really be dissociated from that particular context because it's written with that in mind. And it strays, but there are terrible things happen in Uncle Tom's Cabin as well. But sentimentality makes them bearable in certain ways. But I do find the infanticide a really bold stroke, and it was based upon a true story that Barrett Browning had been told. I mean, her family owned these enormous plantations in Jamaica, 10,000 acres, which were called Oxford and Cambridge, but I suspect they were not very similar to the Oxford and Cambridge of Great Britain. And Cinnamon Hill was the main sort of plantation, was the house where her brother went. One of them died, one of them hated it out there. And so it was an ongoing experience for her in her family. And she would write her name, Elizabeth Barrett of Wimpole Street and Cinnamon Hill. So it was kind of part of her status, so to speak, but an abhorrent part.
And lots of the little incidental details in the poem are taken from the letters that her brother writes back from.
Bro? Yeah,
right.
Okay.
And she expresses her terrible regret that he should be, forced to spend his time out in this, brutalizing place of the plantation. But as you say, at the same time, the family wealth was flowing across the Atlantic quite consistently.
Well, I think that narrative is an interesting one in terms of the context of the poem, just because slave money tainted vast percentages of the British population, and that there was in many ways no escape from it, but it was difficult for anyone to feel that they were not in some ways participating in the slave trade or benefiting from it.
She writes a great letter to Ruskin at one point, I mean, some years after writing this poem, where she says, "I belong to a family of West Indian slaveholders, and if I believed in curses, I should be afraid." And that's quite good for the connection with the poem too, isn't it? Because the poem starts out as a curse poem.
Yes.
That's what the woman is going to do to the Pilgrim Fathers and by extension their descendants. Yes. But then, of course, it ends at the very end. The curse doesn't happen. They're curse-free at the end because she's come to some kind of spiritual development or something. I'm not quite sure.
Has she transcended it in some way? It's where the religion sort of kicks in, doesn't it? And in, often I feel this in reading texts relating to slavery, that without religion, the unbearableness is beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
That some kind of sense of an afterlife is utterly necessary for any survival at all, because otherwise one would just give up. So, it is quite kind of graphic when she talks about how she kills the baby. And he moaned and trembled from foot to head. He shivered from head to foot, till after a time he lay instead, too suddenly still and mute. I felt beside a stiffening cold. I dared to lift up just a fold, as in lifting a leaf of the mango fruit. So it does give us the moment of death of this child, and it is creating the desperate nature of her plight at this moment. It is pretty kind of hard-hitting.
It is horror, isn't it, really?
Yes.
I mean, it really is. My own child, I could not bear to look in his face. It was so white.
I mean, of course, that's also contradicting one of the most fundamental sort of, you know, ideals of 19th century family life, the motherhood, you know.
Absolutely.
The worship of the mother and the maternity and so on.
I mean, in terms of the sentimentalism of the poem, I mean, that's the real clincher, isn't it? We know we're in a very bad space here, a very bad patriarchal space ruled over by a bad god, because it's destroyed motherhood. It's corrupted motherhood into infanticide.
Yes, and I think, I mean, readers of Beloved will sort of recall in that text it's called Gothic often, or it's related to the Gothic. But there is in both texts there is a kind of realism about it as well, which is particularly difficult to cope with. Your fine white angels who have seen nearest the secret of God's power. It does get quite kind of satirical and mocking, and it undoes so many of the kind of tropes of goodness and naturalness and fruits and so on, and also of the spiritual world, these angels, these white angels. And then even more kind of ghastly, I think, is her carrying the corpse around with her as well. I carried the little body on. And we don't quite learn how she escapes. She just somehow seems to be on the road in a kind of almost in a state of trauma.
Well, it's madness, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's important that she's sort of precipitated into a state of insanity. How successful do you think the madness is? Once the child is dead, this is a sort of verse 28, once the child is dead, then there's a weird kind of presumably utterly delusional reconciliation between mother and child. And thus we two were reconciled, the white child and black mother thus. For as I sang it soft and wild, the same song. She wasn't able to sing to the child when it was alive, but now that the child is dead, she's able to sing just as she sang to her lover. The same song, more melodious, rose from the grave, whereon I sat. It was the dead child singing that to join the souls of both of us. So, I mean, this really is high kind of Victorian kind of melodrama.
Yes, though it does go back, as I think you mentioned when we were discussing it before, to The Thorn by William Wordsworth, which is another poem about infanticide, isn't it?
Mm.
So that there is a kind of track record in relation to emotion about a mother and the grave of the child that she's killed. And yes, it gets to be a bit like a sort of stained glass window almost, doesn't it, in that passage, them both, the child singing. But we are also, I think, aware that this is delusional. This is delusional as well. It's whether there is supposed to be any sense of comfort for us as readers in this notion that she's beyond suffering almost at this point and is somehow able to participate in a religious iconography which would allow the somehow a union between her and her child through death.
Yeah.
Once they're dead, she can forget that the child is half white, and she can somehow bond with it. But that is not exactly comforting, is it?
Not at all. No, it's a very dark and unhappy kind of wit in the poem. But there is something quite witty going on about, for example, the idea of union, isn't there? I mean, there's mother to child union, but also union with a capital U for, you know, the union of the United States.
Yes.
Sort of being played one against the other. You in this, for in this union you have set two kinds of men in adverse rows, each loathing each. And the you that she's addressing has now shifted a bit. She starts off addressing the, you know, the absent spirits of the Pilgrim Fathers, but now she's addressing the men who have come to track her down, who seem continuous with the Pilgrim Fathers in some other odd and unsettling.
Yes, ye are born of the Washington race.
Yeah,
and this land is the free America, and this mark on my wrist, I prove what I say. Ropes tied me up here to the flogging place. But it does make sense. Slavery started in the 17th century. I mean, it goes back as far as America. Well, it started long before that, but American slavery was almost kind of started at the same time in the early 17th century as the colonization and the extermination of the indigenous peoples. So in terms of the heroic myths of America, this poem does sort of undermine them, and Free America has a particularly kind of caustic sound at this particular point. But I suppose it's also appealing in terms of the abolitionist propaganda to a concept of America as an ideal, the promised land, the kind of city on a hill, all that utopian rhetoric which is involved in all figurations of America from the Mayflower through Bradford and Plymouth Plantation and so on and so on, is sort of instinct in American rhetoric. So the caustic can also release a sense of, yes, let's do something about this. Let's recover a vision of America.
Utopian at the same time.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? So as we come towards the end, and this very striking ending, the penultimate verse seems to me in some ways one of the most audacious in terms of the religious feeling within the poem. Because here what the speaker does is to compare the suffering of the slaves to Christ's suffering, but with the twist that their suffering is entirely inefficacious. I mean, Christ's suffering was appalling and unimaginable, but at least it managed to bring redemption.
Yeah.
And what they have is a kind of a terrible parody of Christ's suffering, which is without any kind of spiritual point or achievement of any kind at all. We are too heavy for our cross. It's very, again, bearing in mind her own personal religious beliefs, the poet's own personal religious beliefs, it's a very extraordinary piece of writing, I think.
And the line after that is particularly incendiary, and fall and crush you and your seed.
Yeah.
That, again, the thought of active rebellion, which had been tried by Nat Turner in 1831, I think it was, the idea, but obviously in Haiti in the early, late 18th century, and that the vision of the slaves rising up was again one that stalked the southern white imagination. This idea of falling and crushing you and your seed somehow, that America, the experiment of America will founder on slavery.
Yeah.
And that it will be exterminated
by
it. And to an extent, she is looking forward rather proleptically, given it's, 1847, to the outbreak of hostilities in 1861, there was the shameful compromise of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850 and all the palavering in the 1850s to attempt to keep the South on side. But secession is kind of predicted in this poem, isn't it? I think, the end returns us to this moment in which her life is about to be over. I mean, we realize it's a theatrical event. It's a dramatic monologue that she couldn't speak it if she had died. But within the kind of parameters of the poem's way it works, she gives us this notion of her somehow, and it is a religious one, escaping her pains and sort of being transfigured into some kind of or translated to somewhere beyond. I fall, I swoon, I look at the sky, the clouds are breaking on my brain. I am floated along as if I should die of liberty's exquisite pain. In the name of the white child waiting for me, in the death dark where we may kiss and agree, white men, I leave you all curse-free in my broken heart's disdain.
Thank you. Our next conversation will be about Percy Bysshe Shelley's great revolutionary dream vision, The Mask of Anarchy. If you enjoyed this episode, please do try signing up to the Close Readings subscription, where you'll find our full 12-part series on 19th and 20th century long poems and short stories, The Long and Short. And lots of other things as well. There's the full series of Medieval Beginnings with Irina Dumitrescu and Mary Wellesley, and Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones. And there are three new series running this year. On Satire with Colin Burrow and Claire Bucknell, Human Conditions with Judith Butler, Pankaj Mishra, Brent Hayes Edwards and Adam Schatz, and a second series of Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones. And even more, you can hear the first series that Mark and I did together on modern and modern-ish poets, and listen to this series on political poems without any annoying ads. So please do give it a go. You can sign up directly in Apple Podcasts or in other podcast apps. Just follow the links in the description.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.